So, tonight, I'm going to give a talk I've never given before. It's always an adventure when you do a new talk. I call this one the three modes of practice. In the world, on the cushion, daily on the cushion, and on retreat. And I want to talk about this because it talks about something I think that's really important. We often sort of, if we're not careful, we start thinking about practice as, you know, that time we sit every day. And then there's the rest of my life. But that's sort of a narrow view of what the Buddha taught and about what practice actually is. It isn't enough just to sit on the cushion for an hour or half an hour or 45 minutes, whatever you do, 20 minutes every day. It's a start. It's a very good start. But we need to really start looking at practice as synonymous with life. And so what this talk is about is how we can somehow do that. How we can make our practice deeper, broader, more inclusive. And I'm going to spend a fair amount of time actually talking about how to practice in the world. Because if we can't take the Buddha's teachings and apply them to our daily life, why are we bothering doing this at all? I'm saying that very seriously. If you can't take the Buddha's practice into your life, into how you live in the world, it's not a very useful thing. Because we spend, when you think about it, most of our time just living, not practicing. Even if you do retreats, you know, you don't go, you know, well, maybe some of you go for a retreat 6 months out of a year, but not too many people do that. So that's the main part of our practice, is living, just living our lives out there in the world day to day. So I want to sort of give a whole bunch of different suggestions about how we can actually make our practice more part of our life. Because more usually, you know, out there when we're just running around doing our jobs and taking care of our kids and our families and hanging out and whatever, we're just sort of going along. And what I want to talk about is how we can stop and look a little bit once in a while. First of the things I want to talk about is something that is one of my favorite Thich Nhat Hanh suggestions. So imagine there you are driving along in your car or riding your bike because you're a good bolder person or whatever, and you come to a red light. Often our reaction when we come to a red light is, right? Frustration. It's because in our minds, we're already at our destination. We're thinking about, and then I'm going to do this, and I got to go to that store, and then I got to go to that store, and then I can meet that guy for coffee. And we're already, you know, three steps ahead of where we actually are in the moment. So the red light is seen as a problem. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, just flip that over and go, oh, red light, great. Now I can just sit still and take a few breaths and pay attention to my breath. Look at the red light as an opportunity to practice. And this doesn't have to be red light. Maybe some of you don't drive a car. Maybe you're not one of those people that gets around in the car a lot. I'm a handyman, so I'm always driving around town doing things. But it can be anything. It could be every time you open your front door, pause. Every time you wash a dish. Every time you flush the toilet. Doesn't matter what it is. It's you make that moment a moment that reminds you to stop wherever you're hurrying off to next. And just take a few breaths. Just be mindful of what's actually arising in that moment right now. And now your practice is happening all the time. If you choose, you know, you can choose two or three different things if you, you know, really want to get into it. It's still not going to take you more than a couple of minutes a day. But it's like you're constantly coming back to mindfulness. You're constantly being reminded to come back and be mindful again. It's just by doing this little simple mental trick. And you'll, of course, forget sometimes and be at a red light steaming. And then you'll go, oh, yeah, this is an opportunity. Mindfulness will arise. It's good. The practice is also extremely valuable when you find yourself in some sort of crisis mode. You know, when things aren't going so well, when things are just seem like totally out of control. Sounds familiar to most of you, I suspect. This is when we want to just pause. Ask yourself, what's going on right now? Just drop that little question into the mind. And then, as best you can, mentally drop right down into your body and pay attention to what's going on in your body. Because your body will give you all kinds of clues as to the emotional mental state. The body's a total reflection of what's going on in your heart mind. And just taking that little pause, sometimes you'll go, oh, that's what's going on. You know, sometimes it'll be like, duh, I don't know. You know, but even that's information, and you've paused. You've stopped that flight of whatever was going on, of crisis. Just long enough that things can sort of settle down a little bit. So use the practice when things are difficult. That's when we need it most. That's why we're practicing, to be able to deal with that difficult stuff. That's one reason we practice, is that it allows us to catch ourselves in the midst of the difficulty, see it for what it is, just more stuff arising in the mind, and not get so caught by it, not get so wound up. Also, we can be, in our daily practice, in our practice out there in the world, in our life, we can be consciously trying to practice the five precepts. You know, these are the guidelines for leading a virtuous life. I will remind you of them, even though this is something I know many of you have heard many times. The five precepts are non-harming, taking only what is offered, mindful speech, abstaining from sexual misconduct, and refraining from the abuse of alcohol and drugs that lead the cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness, is the actual whole phrase there. I like that. Now, David recently talked about these in his talks on the Ten Paramis, so I'm not going to spend more time than this talking about the precepts. But these are like, once again, if you find yourself in one of those places, just go, how does this relate to the five precepts? And it's often that'll help you make a skillful, mindful decision about what comes next. Just by relating what's happening to the five precepts, which are a guide to virtuous life. You know, in many Dhamma talks and suttas, the Buddha talks about how virtue leads directly to enlightenment. Everything is based on virtue. So if you can look at it from that angle, sometimes just stop and look at the five precepts and how what's going on in your life at that moment related to the five precepts, and that will often help you make a decision on how you proceed from there. The interesting thing is there's actually more than five precepts. I mean, if you're a monk, there's like 174 or something like that, but we won't worry about those. You know, there's things like you can't carry grain more than 5 miles and things. I mean, a very strict rule, how you tie your robe. But the next three, I think, are quite interesting. And these are often taught only in the context of retreat, but I want to look at them tonight in terms of how they relate to leading our daily lives. So let's look at them first here. The next three are to refrain from eating at the forbidden time. We'll talk about that in a second. To refrain from dancing, singing, music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, using perfumes, and beautifying the body with cosmetics. And to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place. But these all, these have more to do not with virtue so much as renunciation, restraint. It's like the next phase, in a sense, of the precepts. The first five precepts are really, virtuous moral statements. Now we're talking about, let's restrain ourselves a little bit. But how do these apply to daily life? Well, on retreat, not eating at a forbidden time, if you take eight precepts on retreat, means you don't eat after noon, which is what all Theravadan monks do. The idea being that if you don't waste all that time eating later on in the evening, you'll have more time to practice. And when you try and practice in the evening, you won't be full from the evening meal, which makes you fall asleep. I'll tell you personally, I resisted this precept for many, many retreats. I was like, oh, I'm a big guy. I need my meals, Plus, I love to eat and cook, And then a couple of long retreats ago, I said, I got to try this out. Everybody talks about how great it is to not eat after the noon meal. And it was the easiest thing in the world. It was like I avoided it. I was afraid of it. And I just said, okay, I think I'll just try this out. And all of a sudden, I had way more energy in the evening. I didn't have problems with sleepiness. And I had more time to practice. In fact, 5 o'clock when everybody else was going for their evening meal, I was in the showers because nobody else was there. And I always got my shower right away, which was great. So I had creative use of the time, I guess. So what does this mean in daily life, however? Because it's not too likely we're going to stop eating the evening meal in our daily lives. It really means, I think, more about being conscious of how much we eat. Not eating too much. Trying to eat local, which is much better for the environment. There's lots of ways you could look at this. You don't really need fresh raspberries from Peru in February. Sort of thought, we've sort of gotten used to being able to have anything anytime, but it's a really environmental disaster eating that way in terms of the amount of energy used to get those raspberries from wherever they're growing down in South America to here. It's frightening. 50 years ago, you ate raspberries when there was raspberries, right? And you ate apples, and you had some things like apples, and if you had lots of raspberries, you made raspberry jam, and that was your raspberries in the summer, in the winter. Little pet peeve. But it also means eating wholesome, nutritious food, I think, as well. Just eating well so that you can keep your body healthy and strong. You could think of this precept in that context. So that when you do eat your nice small meals, locally grown food, it's nutritious. The second of these two, the whole list of things that avoid dancing, singing, music, blah, 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 seems sort of kind of austere. Well, on retreat, that's real easy because none of that's going on anyway, right? This is like everybody laughs when they hear this is one of the retreat ones because it's like, well, so what? We're not going to do any of that stuff anyway, The closest you come to singing is chanting the precepts, maybe. But in daily life, what does this mean in daily life? I think this in daily life, this points to two habits that our culture encourages us to follow. One is to entertain ourselves as much as possible, to avoid being bored, and to beautify ourselves, to make ourselves look hot, sexy, cool, whatever words you choose there. Right? The thing about how we constantly are trying to find ways to entertain ourselves is basically distracting ourselves so that we don't have to really pay attention. And because when we do pay attention, we think, yeah, this is boring. When I first, my first long retreat, I remember going to the teacher I was working with. It was about 2 weeks into the retreat, and I went to him and said, God, this is really boring. You get up in the morning and you start meditating and you meditate and you eat and you meditate and you eat and you meditate and you go to sleep. You know, that was sort of what's going on, you know, and it's like, this is boring. And he looked at me with a little smile, like a knowing smile on his face. He says, yeah. He said, boredom is simply not paying enough attention. That's it. You're not paying enough attention to what's actually arising in the moment. If you really start to pay attention, it's not boring at all. It's, wow, look at that. What's happening in my mind right now? It's the opposite of boring. But it's just a matter of paying attention. Yeah. So, and I'm not preaching here. You should never, go to a movie or watch a Netflix thing or, play a game of words with friends with your friends in Tennessee or something like that. I'm saying we have to think about it and go, am I just doing this all the time and not, I could be using some of this time that I entertain myself all the time with to practice or study instead. And just shift the ratio, perhaps. And the whole idea of beautifying ourselves with cosmetics and perfumes and the things I mentioned there, it has to do with the whole idea that I'm not good enough. It's our culture encouraging us to beat ourselves up, to look down on ourselves, to not accept things as they are. A huge part of the cosmetics and beauty industry as a whole is trying to make people look younger. Right? Like as if looking old was somehow bad or wrong. Not accepting things as they are. It's really what that's all about. And once again, I'm not saying, I put on my favorite shirt today, that you shouldn't sort of, pay a little bit of attention. You don't want to walk around looking dirty and slovenly. But it's the difference between that and, if I had 12 shirts like this in my closet, that would be excessive, but I don't. I have two Czech shirts, actually. So one's dirty, I can wear the other one, So just, you get where I'm coming from here. The last of these, often traded as to not having a high or luxurious bed, points to two things, I think. One is our culture's habit of telling us we should always have the best of everything. You've only got an iPhone 6, but the iPhone 7's out now, you should have. That idea that we should always, that idea of luxury is good, which is another message our culture is giving us all the time. You should have, a Rolls Royce, not just a Subaru wagon, or whatever. It goes on and on and on. And if we buy into that idea of having a high and luxurious bed, as opposed to just a plain old bed, then what do we have to do? Well, we have to have more money. So we have to work harder to make more money or borrow money and then be in debt so we can have that bed and then have to pay off that debt. It just sucks us into the culture that says, if you're not consuming, your share. You're bringing down the whole country. If the economy isn't growing, there must be something wrong. And you have to contribute. You have to spend your money and be in debt as long as you can, as much as you can. And then you're a good person. And I'm just guessing, basically what I'm saying is, nah, I don't want to buy into that. We don't want to do that. It's the opposite of certainly what the Buddha taught. The Buddha, by the way, the Buddha never said that it was wrong to be rich. In fact, there's a whole section in one of the suttas where he says, if you're rich, that's great. Now you have lots of money to give away to support the Sangha and to give to your children and to support. Use it. Don't hoard it. Use it for wholesome purposes. So it's not wrong to have money, or it's not bad. It's just we get caught up in that. We got to have all this stuff. And then we end up in debt, or we end up living paycheck to paycheck. We end up struggling all the time. And that just takes time away from practice. It's as simple as that. All the time you're spending out there working 60 hours a week, this 60 hours you don't have time to practice. It means, it's pretty hard to go away on retreat because you don't have enough, you're too busy just keeping your head above water. So I think I want to sum up that these three have to do with not buying into the culture that tells us how we should live our lives, and to actually simplify our lives as much as you can. I mean, you got to have stuff. You've got kids. You've got a job. You need a car to get to the job. You got to have a house. I'm not saying you shouldn't have stuff, but look at it all and go, do I really need this? And if you don't, give it away. Or sell it on Craigslist, I suppose. But get rid of it. Yeah. It really feels good when you get rid of stuff. My wife and I have a huge collection of books. One of my big sins. And we just went through our bookshelves and took a whole 3 boxes of books off our bookshelves and just gave them away. And it was like, what a relief. All those books gone. Now I don't have to take care of them. I don't have to, keep dusting them all the time. they're gone. And I hadn't read any of those books in like 10 years. And David, I'm smiling at David because David's been doing this lately, sort of been reducing his life. And he's giving me some of his books, of course. But that's okay. They were great books. So. Okay. And one more aspect of this practice in daily life I want to get across. This is how you carefully choose who you associate with. In another sutta, one of the Buddha's disciples said, something like, Sangha, good Sangha is half of the practice. Is it not, noble sir, or something like that? And the Buddha replied, no, Sangha is all practice. Having good companions, having people who you associate with, being immersed in the Dhamma like you are, is all of the practice, he said. Of course, he said many other things were all of the practice too, but when I read this, it was like, this is pretty strong. Anyhow, there's a great poet called Naomi, I'm probably pronouncing this wrong, Shihab Nye, who has this great poem called The Art of Disappearing that speaks to this very topic. And I thought I'd use a bit of poetry to get this across. It's also a great poem, I think. It's called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, don't I know you? Say no. When they invite you to a party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, should we get together? Say, why? It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. When you know you could tumble any second, then decide what to do with your time. Says it all right there. I should say it's a great poet. But okay. Second mode. Now we're going to shift into the second mode of practice. This is daily practice on the cushion. The most important part of daily practice is to have one. To have a daily practice. Every day you practice. As one of my teachers says, every day you got to get your tush on the cush. And it may be that some days, because they're really busy days, that might be 5 minutes. But do that. You know, even if you normally, well, I always practice for 45 minutes, but the shuttle's coming to pick me up from the airport, take me to the airport. I only got 5 minutes. Well, sit for 5 minutes. Sit on the shuttle. I've tried that. It works pretty well, actually, going to the airport. You got nothing else to do. You may as well sit there and practice. But make it something that you do regularly every day. It's so easy to fall into the habit of sitting, doing our practice, our formal practice, you know, when I feel like it, or when I'm feeling happy. You know, I don't want to practice when I'm grumpy because it'll be a grumpy practice, right? But it's not practice. Daily practice is, and here's a bad word, a discipline. In our culture, discipline is like a bad word. But it's not discipline. I grew up in a military family, so maybe it's easier for me. I don't know. But discipline is like, that's what makes practice continuous. If you don't have discipline, if you don't say, okay, I feel like crap and I'm going to go sit anyway, then pretty soon you're not practicing regularly at all. You're back to practicing when you feel like it. The benefits of practice are cumulative. The more regular the practice, the more you practice regularly, the more one session feeds into the next. You just naturally go deeper when you have a daily practice. It just happens. I struggled with this, by the way, for many, many years before I had a really, really regular daily practice. It's hard. It's not easy to do. And part of it is because how it's like we all have really busy lives, right? How am I going to fit half an hour into my already busy schedule? Well, if you can't fit half an hour, fit 20 minutes. Or if you have more than time, then fit 45 minutes, not half an hour. Yeah. And it's just like you have to carve out that time. The best time, speaking as the early bird person, is early in the morning. Some people hate that. It's like early in the morning, it's like, God, if I, you know, I get up, I have my coffee, I go sit. And then I've done it. My discipline is taken care of, you know, from that point of view. It's like, and it's just for me, your mind is clear early in the morning. It's not caught up in all the things that have happened that day and you're not swirling around so much. The other time that's recommended is sunset. Because once again, the world is getting sort of quiet. So evening time. For me, that never works because by 7 o'clock, I'm like half the time. I've been working all day, and it's like, oh, I don't want to do that. It's much, for me, much more difficult to practice in the evening. Some people think the evening is just perfect. I also know people who have their daily practice just before lunch. You know, they get up, they get their stuff done, their important things are done, and then they take half an hour and sit, and then they have lunch. So So it doesn't matter when, just that it's the key is that it's the same time every day. Once again, regularity. Then if it's at the same time every day, then the mind goes, oh, it's that time. And it naturally starts to calm down. It naturally starts to actually shift modes. The other thing you want to watch for, if you can, is to have this practice always in the same place. You know, whether it's a particular chair that's in one corner of your two-room flat. You know, I have a little room in my garage that's my sitting room. And it's not that big, but it's fine for me. And I have a couple of pictures of the Buddha and my clock and my chair and my bench and all my various accoutrements. And that's what that space is used for. It's my sitting space. So as much best you can, always do it in the same place. And if you can, this is more difficult, don't use that space for anything else. I had friends who had a meditation closet. They had a little altar in the closet, and they'd open the door, and they'd sit in front of the closet. And then when they're finishing, they'd close the door, and they'd never open that door except when they were going to sit. Didn't store anything in the closet. It was just their meditation. Because they didn't have a room, an extra room, but they had an extra closet. So you can be creative here. And you do want to decorate it a little bit. Maybe it's just a little saying written on a piece of paper or a picture of the Buddha or a picture of, you know, if you have a teacher, bring a picture of your teacher. You know, whatever suits you in terms of just something that gives it that sort of flavor of this is my practice space. It's important not to get discouraged with daily practice. This is the other thing I want to mention. Stuff is going to happen, and you're going to miss a day. Don't at that point go, oh, that's it, I'm finished. Just start again. And start again. And start again. And eventually, it'll become regularly every day. It just, you know, in the lives we lead, if you ever have to, you know, catch a plane at 5 a.m, well, when I catch a plane at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m, other than maybe if I'm really disciplined, I might do a little practice in the shuttle. But these days I often drive to the airport and park my car. Well, I can't meditate and drive. It doesn't work. So I don't sit that morning. That's it. It's not the end of the world. I just make sure I sit the next morning for sure. No matter where I am. I've sat in hotel rooms and all kinds of places. It's amazing. And daily practice, no matter what discipline you go into, no matter what form of Buddhism or Hinduism or Sufism or any other ism you want to look at, all of them, without exception, emphasize daily practice. So this isn't some sort of weird Theravadan Buddhist idea. This is something that goes through all traditions and all teachings. That daily practice, that sort of recharging the battery every day, that's time when I'm not rushing around, when I'm just still. Just slow down, sit, practice. It's so important in keeping your life on a somewhat more even keel. Daily practice really helps you deal with all that craziness in your life because you're just taking time every day to not be crazy, essentially. I'm just going to sit here and not pay attention to all that stuff. And now it's all going to come up anyway, but now you're going to see it from a different perspective, from the perspective of a still mind that's sitting. And sometimes that is very useful as well. So the two feed off each other quite clearly. Third mode of practice is retreat. And in all Buddhist traditions, and in fact many other forms of tradition, I'm familiar with the Buddhist ones, retreat is built into the teaching. You know, the Buddha was always basically saying to anybody who came along, it was going to be used to say, well, okay, good. Go sit at a river tree or in some little hut someplace in the forest and practice. Go on a retreat. First thing he ever usually told anybody, you're going to be a monk, go on a retreat. If you're going to do the practice, go on a retreat. It's just, it's built in. It's so deeply embedded in the practice. What is it? What do you mean by what does going on retreat mean? Essentially means stopping all the things you normally do. Remove all the things you normally use to distract yourself. Be silent. No reading, no writing, no music. In more traditional forms, no eye contact with anyone else. And just sit. Or sit and then walk and then sit and then walk. I mean, you know, you can practice in various forms. But just step back from the daily life completely and just dedicate that day or that week or that month or whatever it is to just practice. That's what retreat means. It's so powerful, even for a day. Just think what it would be like. Just imagine now having 8 hours, which is the length of a day long, where you don't talk, you don't read, you don't write, you don't answer your phone, you don't go on your computer. You just sit and walk, practice, listen to Dhamma talk. It's just a totally refreshing thing to do. And just as I said, in daily practice, the more regular you are, the deeper you go. That's what happens in retreat. That's the value of retreat, is that in 8 hours, you can start going actually deeper than in your 45-minute daily practice. The practice, the more you practice and the more continuous that practice is, the deeper you go, the more still you become, the more calm you become, the more focused you become, the more mindful you become, the more concentrated you become, the more full of loving kindness you become. It just works. It may not be pleasant, however. I mean, it's kind of difficult to give up all those things for any period of time. But it's also some of the sweetest moments in my life have all been, almost all of them, other than maybe meeting my wife and getting married, having a few kids. Other than those, all the sweet things in my life when I really think about it are on retreat. The real powerful moments where I go, wow. That's what retreat's about. Retreat is about wow to me sometimes. It might be, oh my God, instead of wow, but you know, it's stronger stuff. From the outside, when I talk about retreat like this, it looks like, oh, this is going to be kind of difficult, you know, to give up everything and just practice. But this amazing thing happens on retreat when you're sitting with other people. There's the energy of Sangha arises. And you're having a bad day, maybe. You're having a day where you're really struggling and you look around. And you see all these people who are just so dedicated to the practice, who are sitting there and they're so still. And it's like, oh, it's okay. I can get through this difficult day because all these other people are here. And you just literally feel their energy. You get to know people, even though you don't know their names. Or in some cases, because you're sitting behind them, all you know is the back of their head. You know, but you really get a feeling of connection to people that is I don't have experienced in any other time. You really know people in a very different way. It's very powerful. And that energy makes actually being on a retreat easy. Or much easier. It's just, it pulls you along somehow. Now, I'm sure some of you are sitting there thinking, yeah. You know, I'd love to go on retreat, but, you know, I wrote down a list here, the ones I've used. I'm too busy. I'm too old. I'm not well enough. I have too many responsibilities in the world. I have kids. I have aging parents, etc. We all have 1,000 excuses why we can't go on retreat. And I'm here to tell you none of them are true. And I want to give a little example here. So just imagine, I want you to have to use your imagination here. You get up in the morning. You don't turn on your computer and you keep your phone turned off. You maybe have your cup of coffee first, like I do. No coffee, no practice. It's real simple. Instead, you just sit. You know, you've done your morning washing routine. You've had your cup of Joe if you really need one. Then you go sit. No TV, no radio, no computer, no phone. Everything's turned off. And then after you sit, you have a nice, healthy breakfast in silence. And then you go for a walk out in the neighborhood. You know, go outside, get some fresh air, exercise. You know, maybe have a dog. Well, then get to walk the dog. Yeah, I walk the dog anyway. And then you come home and you sit again. And then after you sit again, you do some walking practice. And then after you do some walking practice, you sit again. You've just been on retreat. That's all it is. You could go on retreat right in your own apartment or house or wherever you live, anytime you want, for as long as you want. Even if it's just like this, by now it's maybe 11 in the morning. You're desperate to turn on your phone. But that's a retreat. Just do that once a week or once a month even. And now you can go on retreat. There's no one who can't do what I just described. I mean, if you live with a bunch of other people, you might have to do a little organizing. You know, kids, I'm not going to talk to you till 11 o'clock this morning, no matter what. You know, and if your kids are old enough, they'll understand. If you have really small kids, it's going to be a problem. But then maybe you arrange for someone to babysit so you can have a half-day retreat in your own house. Or if you live with someone who practices, do it together. Even better. Now you've got, not only have you have a retreat, but you have Sangha. Even better. Just like that. So anyone can go on retreat anytime. You just have to decide to do it. You just have to say, this is more important than anything I might find on my phone or my computer between now when I get up until 11 o'clock this morning. I can manage to get by and not have to deal with the world for a few hours. And now you've been on the street. And then you sort of graduate from that maybe to going on a day long sometime. And then just keep looking. And you'll find there are so many opportunities for retreat. There's an incredible thing called the Buddhist Insight Network that has a website that has hundreds of retreats on it. Of varying lengths, some just for women, some for, you know, the LGBTQ community, some for, you know, and it has Tai Chi involved in it. It's incredible what's out there if you just start to look around. Let alone just on our website, you know, the IMCC website, there's always something going on. There's lots of day-longs and longer retreats there all the time. So you don't have to look very far if you want to do more. If you want to do something longer than just 4 hours. Just that 4 hours in the morning is just such a great thing to do. Just have your own little retreat. Just turn off the world for 4 hours. It's so powerful just to have that continuity of practice. Just tying pieces together, making it longer. So, now after I got to the end of this talk when I was writing it, and I said, oh, there's one other question I really haven't answered here. Why is retreat so impractical? Why is not retreat? Why is practice so important? Why is it important that we practice the Buddha's teachings? I mean, that is a question we probably should ask ourselves. You know, are we just sort of entertaining ourselves in some rather odd way? Or is there something more to the question of why we do this in the first place? And I'm going to try and answer this question as best I can through poetry. I'm going to cheat, in other words. This is a poem by Hafiz, Sufi related to Rumi in his style, but somewhat more effervescent, I think, than Rumi even. It's called I Got Kin. Plant so that your own heart will grow. Love so God will think, ah, I got kin in that body. I should start inviting that soul over for coffee and rolls. Sing because this is food our starving world needs. Laugh because that is the purest sound. It's talking about life and how to lead a life. Laugh because that is the purest sound. If you're joyful, if you're full of loving kindness, if you're calm, if you're mindful, you actually radiate that energy out into the world. You become a source of calm and stillness and joy in the world. That's why I practice. Because that's, to me, the only thing I can do to make any difference in the world. The only thing I can do is, as best I can, be a radiator of the Buddha's energy and teachings. Just pour it out there into the world. And the more of us that do that, the more often we do that, the more the world changes. It's really, I think, that simple. A few more poems here. One more. I have to read some Mary Oliver. It wouldn't be right to not have Mary Oliver here. And this is from a longer poem called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. And this is just the last section. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I have gone out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. And I have become a child of the clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this, which is all I know? Love yourself, then forget it, then love the world. That's why we practice. That's why having three modes is so important, because it makes this more possible. Dedicating the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.